This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we bring you a forum that looks at the current state of the opioid epidemic here in Utah and nationwide. According to new data released by Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox's office, in 2017, Utah's number of prescription opioid overdose deaths declined for the third consecutive year by almost 20%. Utah was one of only 9 states nationwide to observe a decrease in opioid overdose deaths from 2016 to 2017. So why did that decline happen? And what is Utah doing today to combat the opioid epidemic? Speaking on today's panel, Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes, Utah Assistant Attorney General Scott Reed, Utah Naloxone Director Dr. Jennifer Plum, USDA State Director Randy Parker, and moderating today's panel is Laura Jones, producer at local radio station KRCL. Here's Laura Jones.
Really privileged to do this conversation. Every time I get the opportunity, I jump at it because I have lost a family member to substance abuse and another one who struggles with it. So show of hands, how many people here today are in the same boat? That's a lot. You can see how extensive even our panelists this issue is. And even though the Senate has a bipartisan opioid package, what are the myths? What are the truths? What are the breakthroughs nationally, but here in our community as well? So let's start with our panelists giving a bit of a statement or two on their take on this issue today. Dr. Jennifer Plum will start.
Thank you all for joining. I have a little bit of a hoarse voice. Apologies for that. My take on this issue has been informed by 22 years plus of struggle. I lost my brother to a heroin overdose in 1996, so this has been in Utah a lot longer than these dialogues have been. That was actually right before I started medical school, and so I've since then come to see this issue from a family member side, from a physician and prescriber side, and more recently as kind of a community advocate and activist side, trying to draw attention to this issue and to empower people to save lives by using what is essentially a pure antidote called naloxone or Narcan, if you've ever heard of it, to get it in people's hands to reverse an opiate overdose. We are in such a position with this that you know, Narcan does not fix this problem. It doesn't cure this problem, but we are losing people in such dire rates and numbers that we've got to keep them alive while the system tries to do better by keeping people having better options. So I'm really pleased to be here. I think that all of us are hoping for the same thing, and that is that this will not continue and that it will get better, and that, you know, Utah was fourth in the nation not that long ago for overdose deaths. We're not anymore, but it's still sadly just as bad as it was. Our death rate is exactly what it was when we were fourth in the nation. We're 21st in the nation now. We're losing as many people, but states are leapfrogging over us. We've got to do better to have that turnaround.
How does this compare to other injury deaths or other categories?
Yeah, so overdose or poisoning death is the leading cause of injury death in our state. So injury deaths means preventable deaths, right? If the injury doesn't happen, then the death doesn't happen. If you combine, you ask a lot of families, I work in pediatrics, I'm in a pediatric emergency medicine doctor, and if I ask a lot of families what they're worried about losing their kids to, they'll talk about cars, car crashes, they'll talk about guns, gun violence. Well, if we compare and put together gun violence, gun deaths, and car crash deaths, they're still barely reaching what we're losing to overdoses. So it is by far and away the leading cause of injury-related death in our state.
Sean Reyes, Attorney General, State of Utah.
Thank you. And just to add to what Dr. Plum was saying, if you look at the gravity of the number of deaths by overdose in 2016, so this was a couple of years ago in the United States, exceeded the number of all of the fatalities that we had during the entire Vietnam War conflict. If you look at the number of deaths by overdose related to opioids, that number exceeds the number of losses. And I'm not trying by comparison to minimize anything, but just so that we understand what we're talking about, eclipses the number of losses of deaths by breast cancer, which is something that we are all aware of, thankfully, and that we unite behind. This is something now that we have to take by the reins. And thank goodness for people like Jen Plum. I want to take whatever time I have to brag about for a moment the people that I'm sitting with, because I don't think that there Is anyone, maybe there are a few, if any, in the United States who have done more than Dr. Plum to help address this issue? It's ugly, it's dark, and thankfully politicians and people of influence in a lot of different spheres are now paying attention, but that wasn't always the case. And 5 years ago or 10 years ago, when Jen was one of those voices crying in the wilderness and people just weren't listening, she was there, dedicated her career and her life to saving people and lifting people. And so it's an honor to be here with Jen. She's known as Naloxone because that is such a critical tool that we have, but she does so much beyond that. So thanks, Jen. Randy Parker, thanks. That deserves a hand. Sorry, I talked too fast. My guys are like, applause line. You should give her a standing ovation, to be honest. We can do that afterwards at the end. Randy Parker helped run the Utah Farm Bureau for years and years, and is somebody who knows very intimately the challenges of the rural communities, is in a position now with the USDA and a director over outreach to our rural communities, a leader for the state at the federal government level who's now bringing needed resources to Utah, and particularly focusing on, just out of curiosity, are any of you from rural communities here? Raise your hand. So maybe you're underrepresented here because actually by population there should be at least a couple more hands up. But I grew up both in an urban and a rural community. I'm telling you, the impacts are devastating. They're amplified and magnified for a lot of reasons, which I won't get into immediately right now. But Randy Parker has been at the front lines and is leading the charge now for us in many ways in Washington, D.C. So I wanted to acknowledge him and let you all know what a great leader we have here. Thank you, Randy. You want to give him a round of applause? Let's do that so no one feels shortchanged. And last but not least, someone who is helping us change the narrative about this issue, to help us remove the stigma, to help us remove shame and judgment so that we can be more honest. Jen's been doing that for years. Scott Reed has been doing it for decades also. He's been a leader in the Utah Attorney General's office. He used to run our largest or second largest division, largest criminal division, and has now transitioned into a position where, based on his experience at the legislature, on national policy, and he may mention a new appointment that you just received, Scott. What is it?
I've been appointed to the board of the National Alliance of Model State Drug Laws.
Right. Critical for Utah. Thanks for mentioning that, because that gives us a seat at the table to help be able to take ideas that you have, things that are critical to you, and weave those into national policy. So Scott has been a prosecutor, led in the AG's office, and has prosecuted, right now is with the DEA, representing cases, prosecuting cartel leaders and traffickers, those who supply and bring in a lot of the opiates, and who enslave others. So it's not just drug trafficking, human trafficking. He's the one that works closely with our DEA partners to prosecute those. And so if I can leave one final thought, this is a multifaceted issue that affects everyone. And if you haven't been touched by this, God bless you. You are so fortunate. I would say more lucky than anything else, because statistically, the odds are it's going to hit you if it hasn't already sooner or later, with a direct family member or somebody that you love and care about, a friend. I know that's played out for us multiple times, manyfold. So we need all of you, and you can make a difference. If there's one thing I want to try to continue to emphasize, you may not be able to change insurance companies and how they fund treatment and care. You may not be able to change other things, but every single one of us can do certain things, like take drugs out of medicine cabinets and make sure that we don't keep those things, and wake other people up around you to be honest and have these conversations. So with that, I'm going to turn the mic over again to our USDA State Director, Randy Parker, unless you had a... I probably spent... overspent my time.
Well, you're a politician, of course. Yeah. You just take that away from...
And the lawyers.
Well, Mr. Parker, I'm curious, what does the U.S. Department of Agriculture have to do with fighting the opioid crisis?
Thank you for this opportunity to be here with these great leaders in the state of Utah on this. General Reyes, I appreciate the partnership we have so much, my friend. I am a farm kid. I'm one of those oddities here in this group. I come from a family farm down in Utah County. So that's where my heart and soul comes from. Now, I'm the state director of rural development, which we receive resources from Congress to invest in rural prosperity. Well, this crisis, the opioid crisis, is having dramatic impacts on our rural people. And the president, some months ago, issued a declaration, and he told federal agencies, this is an all hands on deck. And USDA Rural Development, we were asked to take a lead role in reaching out to rural communities. I'm going to give you some statistics, hopefully not a lot of them, but they're important. The American Farm Bureau and the National Farmers Union did a survey, and they found that 74% of farmers, ranchers, and those that work on America's farms and ranches have been adversely impacted by misuse of opiates or opiate abuse. That's troubling and dramatic. Now, bring that, roll that back here to Utah, and we're seeing some great things happening. Thank you, Dr. Plum. Good things are happening in Utah. But when you think of some of our rural counties, Carbon County, Utah, is the fifth hardest hit county in America for opiate deaths. They're losing an average of 53 people a year. That's more than double the state average, so that's dramatic. And we have Duchesne County that's at 40. Our rural counties are hardest hit. That's why we are involved in this fight, and we're bringing resources through the U.S. Department of Agriculture to rural communities. And in a moment, I'll tell you about an exciting one we announced yesterday.
Thank you so much. Assistant Attorney General Scott Reed, I'm really curious about your perspective on the Opioid Task Force, Utah Substance Abuse and Mental Health Advisory Council, the Utah Narcotic Officer Association, and what was the new one that you just got, the Model Drug
National
State Law?
National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws. Uh-huh. It's not the most fluid acronym, NAMSL. That's what we ended up
okay. On the microphone, so we get you recorded.
Thanks.
What would you like to share with us?
Well, I'm kind of here to share the law enforcement perspective because it is still a critical component of what we do. Before I do that, I'll get the commercial out of the way. I am an old Ute. I was driving up here today, and I'm going to have to talk to my good friend Jason Perry about this. I think there's, you know, University of Utah students, university faculty, university alums, and now university fossils. I think we need a place at the table, but my career in the AG's office started in 1990, and I ironically came to the office on a grant as the drug guy. And so it's kind of where I've parked a lot of my professional efforts. And I really do, my wife and I both have family members who are in recovery. We understand the nature of the problem from a personal standpoint. But professionally, law enforcement is in the business of reducing the supply of opiates in our country, and I'm sure you recognize, and maybe this room more so than many other groups, that opiates come from south of the border. They're being provided primarily out of Mexico. That wasn't the case 20 years ago, but now we have the opium poppy farms in the foothills of western Mexico, and it's being processed, packaged, and delivered into our country in just phenomenal quantities. They're mind-boggling, the amount of heroin that's coming in, as well as methamphetamine and other drugs. You also are aware, and you should be, and you should be careful, there's this thing called the dark web, and guys like me, when you say dark web, they go, well, just can't you just turn up the contrast on your monitor? And that's the solution. But the drugs that are coming in from Asia that are basically synthetic opioids, fentanyl is the one that you've heard so much about. There are other drugs, and even now synthetic hallucinogens and other things that are being manufactured outside of this country, but in plentiful supply, because those countries understand whether it's a legitimate market or not, that there is a voracious appetite for drugs in this country. And that's really the problem we need to begin to address on the demand side. And that's an important reason why I've become involved at so many other levels of this discussion.
All right. Let's talk about that voracious appetite and where it comes from. I think when we look at these overdose deaths, we're looking at the end result of some social issues or anxiety that we don't like to address in this country or in our community, and we don't like to spend taxpayer dollars on. Jen, do you want to start with that? Dr. Plum, in your work with folks you've been getting naloxone to, can you draw any conclusions or trends about folks and who that addict is?
Yeah. Well, you know, there is something in this country that I don't quite understand. I doubt any of us really does, although we probably have theories. The amount of narcotics or opioids that we use in this country far exceeds the rest of the world. So for starters, in this country, you know, and Scott made reference to it, that as long as there's a demand, there will be a supply, right? America's really good at supply and demand. Go to Costco, you'll see how good at supply and demand we are. And when we have this demand, there will be not only legitimate ways that people find opiate and opioid substances, but unfortunately, these illegitimate and illicit ways that they'll find them. There has been something that's happened in American culture that there is a pill for everything, right? There's a pill literally for restless legs and the little blue pill that has you sitting in the bathtub at the end of the, you know, the with your love holding hands, and there's a pill for this and a pill for that. And we have been, I think, in a lot of ways manipulated by the pharmaceutical industry to believe that we need that. And then, likewise, that our doctors don't care about us unless our doctors provide those pills. And let's be honest, I don't speak for all physicians, but I think that physicians have a fair share in it's super easy to write a prescription. It takes me 15 seconds to sign a prescription. It takes me a lot longer to talk about the life issues that people are having that perhaps a pill will not solve. The worst part about this whole fight for me, or the most frustrating part about this whole battle for me, is that there are very much perceptions among all of us about who that person is. And, you know, there are probably around, giving on the year's data, depending on the year's data, you look at 10 deaths a week in Utah related to overdoses. Maybe closer to one a day when it comes to opiate overdoses. So someone's being buried today, right? Someone's going to be buried tomorrow. Every single, and I say this over and over again, but think about the gravity of this. There will be a funeral every single day and someone planning a funeral. Picture who you think that is that's being buried today. And I won't do a raise of hands thing and grade you all, but I'll tell you, I bet a lot of you think like I do, and that is, mine's based on what I experienced with my brother, but I picture a 22-year-old male. Maybe reckless, maybe shiftless, maybe jobless, maybe homeless. That's what I picture, right? That's the guy. Well, that's not the guy in Utah. And I'm not saying that, again, much like what Attorney General Reyes said, to say that one life matters more than another, but it's not my brother, it's me. It's 45 to 54-year-old women that are the highest of our demographic for overdose deaths. And that isn't, again, to say that, well, it matters more if it looks like me, clearly, right? No, it's that we don't always know who we are addressing, who we need to be worried about, who we need to be aiming resources at, who we need to be concerned about, and likewise in medicine, who we need to be careful that we're not putting at more risk. So I think honestly, I can tell you, we could pull out demographics that would say, okay, the most likely person to overdose and die, which is not always the most likely person to be struggling with substance use disorder, right? But a lot of people who are struggling with substance use disorder and addiction, we don't even know that they're struggling. In this society, especially in this state, it's really hard for people to say, I'm not okay. Things are a problem. I'm not perfect. And so, you know, for me, it goes across the gamut. So much so that in the last week in my ER shifts up at Primary Children's, I've seen three kids, two and under, overdosed on opiates. Those kids aren't taking those opiates, right? But those opiates are everywhere. Opioids are everywhere in our homes and in our purses, in our trucks, in our cars, on our bedside tables. So when we think about this issue, I think the biggest thing that any of us can do for culture shift and for societal change is to say we cannot label it as this one group, that one group. It is literally every single demographic, every single one of us, every single person you look at walking down the street could be that person struggling and is struggling.
Jen, what's the number of
Grab the microphone.
Babies being born? No, I was...
He's asking about for like neonatal abstinence syndrome and being born.
I don't think a lot of people understand.
Yeah.
Born addicted.
Born addicted and have withdrawal symptoms. So as we've gotten more people on opioid substances, medications written by doctors most of the time, but sometimes not, we also have moms that get pregnant, right? We have women that get pregnant, and it is a dependence-creating substance. Little as 7 days on something, your body is dependent on it if it's an opioid. If you're pregnant, everything you take goes right down into the uterus and in utero and goes to the baby. So I've heard, you know, it's across the board, but I've heard as often as every 13 minutes a baby is being born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. I've heard that as much as 20% of our cord data, so when you take umbilical cord blood from babies, that as much as 1 in 5 of them wow. are showing exposure to the opioid substances, which is a reflection of two things. One, we got a whole lot of babies that we're going to be dealing with, but also we got a whole lot of moms.
Yeah.
Is that around the line? Yeah, right? I mean, it's, yeah. Is that around the numbers you have kind of been hearing too?
All right. So how do you craft law then to try and address the issue, Attorney General Reyes? Pass that microphone.
All right. So since I've already been accused of being a politician, I guess I'll just answer whatever I want to answer and try to weave that question in somehow. I do want to mention this before I forget, because I think you can all participate, and this slightly answers the question that Laura asked. That is, we are having a national opioid summit here in Utah, October 12th and 13th. Please mark it down. Please be there if you can be there. There's not a cost. We want everyone to come. It's going to be held at the Vivint Smart Home Arena. I just want to make sure I'm getting the name of their arena correct. It's going to not be a deep dive into policy and procedures and law enforcement issues. We have plenty of those conferences. Trust me, if we attended every opioid conference, because people are waking up to this now, that's all we would do 24/7. So we try to participate where we can. This is more of a wake-up call. It's a celebration. It is to make sure that everybody in Utah understands what kind of a threat we're facing, but also make sure that people are hopeful. And so those who know people, or those who maybe themselves are caught up in the cycle of addiction, are invited to come. We're going to have NBA players. The Jazz will be there. UFC fighters, guys like Court McGee, if some of you know. NFL players. We've got a group. I don't know if I can release the name yet. We're Final Contracts. It's a local band that has gone international. You know them. We would like everybody to come, because what it will take to get good laws passed is making sure that there is enough grassroots pressure from people like you and me, everyday people who talk to the people in power and say, oh, the policymakers, I don't make policy, I just enforce it after the fact, and say, you guys really need to understand what's happening here. And it's happening. People are waking up to that. That's the first one. The second is I want to throw a shout out, because everyone here works on a group called the State Opioid Task Force that we have. And I have the privilege of co-chairing that with one of our musketeers who's not able to be with us today, District Agent in Charge Brian Besser of the DEA. He and I co-chair the task force. We recently brought on United States Senator Mike Lee to bring more federal resources on. He's a terrific partner. And Dr. Plum is on our executive committee. Speaker Greg Hughes is on our executive committee. Randy co-chairs our outreach. Scott is actually our point person and executive director for the organization. And people like Carol Spackman Moss, legislator, some of you might know, she's been a champion for years on these issues. That's how good law happens, is you, in a bipartisan way, put aside partisan politics, because it's not a Democrat issue or a Republican issue. It's a humanitarian issue. It's a public health issue. And historically, we've viewed it from one lens. We in law enforcement have said it's a law enforcement issue, so we've got to investigate and arrest our way out of this issue. And other people from different sides of the issue have, I think, over time, in their silo, tried to attack this problem with good intentions, but not a comprehensive approach. And so we tried to take a step back as a state, recruit leaders and thought leaders from all over to come together and say, what kind of policies would be best for the state? And We have, I'm happy to report, over the last several legislative sessions in the state of Utah, passed a number of laws that give more teeth to prosecutors to go after traffickers, that give more resources to people in recovery, or potentially more. I mean, those things still have to get funded and they have to get rolled out.
For the need.
We don't.
And insurance cuts off at
90 days. And we're not just dealing with the opioid issue. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with death by suicide, other behavioral mental health issues. There's so many things that are interwoven in this. But you're exactly right, Laura. All of those are the compelling challenges that face us to make good policy. But I think unity on this issue, mm-hmm. We don't all agree 100% of the time on everything in terms of the right policy, because Jen brings a medical background. I bring a legal background. And so, but we trust and respect each other enough. And that is what I hope would be the sentiment around the state, which is why we're having this big kickoff mm-hmm. event. Let's come together as a state. In a crisis, if there were a natural disaster, everybody would just come together mm-hmm. and try to figure out a way to help people who are victims of flooding. This is a flood. It's a tsunami. It's like a diluvian type of phenomenon. And I don't know why sometimes we can't get everybody together and put aside politics. So that's one of the critical key issues. The last thing one statistic that is mind blowing. Jen alluded to it. So did Scott. You can check me. Those of you who are
fact checking
right here. What is the population of the United States vis-a-vis the rest of the world? In my mind, I'm thinking somewhere like 5% or so there. Yeah. You go ahead. If it's like, 5.2, or don't rush off and an AG is always lying. 5%, we consume somewhere between 90 to 99% of the world's opioids, somewhere in there. Yeah. So mm-hmm. we're a tiny speck, and we just are a machine for consumption. Like Jen said, because I think we have, as a society, kind of consciously made certain decisions about how we deal with pain. And then the medical community, with good intentions, I think, were part of that, and creating another vital sign, and looking at, we can go through the history and see how we got here. But I think more importantly, it's what do we do now we're here to get out.
And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a panel discussion from a few weeks ago that looks at efforts being made by the state of Utah to combat the opioid epidemic. Here again is the panel's moderator, Laura Jones.
Mr. Parker, I'm curious about rural communities, whether they're farmers or in the extractive industries, or the tourism industry here in Utah. What is it that you're hearing is creating this? Is it despair? Is it pain? Is it injury?
And let me back up just a little mm-hmm. bit, if I could. And I want to compliment General Reyes. As we talked a little less than a year ago about this issue and its impact in rural communities, he had the vision to say, we need a rural opioid work group, and I'm honored to be co-chair of that with Mark Whitney, a county commissioner from Beaver County. And as we started looking at this and how many counties are struggling in rural communities, that their economic foundations are what you just went through: agriculture, mining, timber, energy.
Physically demanding jobs.
They're physically demanding. And here's what we found. Those folks are further removed from medical care. So mm-hmm. when they do go in and they're prescribed for pain, opiates, they might get 90 days. you know, and the physician says, here's 90 days because I know how difficult it is for you to get back. Well, now we're seeing physicians having people come back weekly to make sure that they're monitored properly. Well, in 90 days, many of those people, Dr. Plum, where are they? They're addicted.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're finding. And the vision of the Attorney General and going out and holding opioid roundtables in rural communities has been phenomenal. We've sat with communities from Vernal to Manti, here in Riverton in this valley, and we've heard from those people that are hardworking farmers, ranchers, and so forth, and we've gotten their views on some of what's creating the problems out there.
What it is that there's
a disconnect there, and that's really been identified. But the second part of that is there's some shame and there's some denial. We're hearing that in all of these meetings, that kind of isolates them even more than what they already were. So we're trying to help and have open, honest discussions of what we can do to help. And that's leading to conversations about people that have been out and they've been in rehab and they're coming back into the community. Well, the community doesn't readily open their arms to those folks. So we're trying to figure out how to provide opportunities for transitional housing, because if they go back to where they were in that community, they're right back in the drug culture again. So we're trying to look at some things to help them in that way. And it's been really eye-opening to be out there and be involved in these rural communities and hear from them individually what their problems are. Rural communities in Utah are very different. They have unique cultures and unique personalities, every one of them. Utah only has 9% of our state population that is not in an urban community. So these, in the state of Utah, as immense as it is, they are very isolated members of our society.
I think it's, you know, whether it's we're talking about opioids or homeless issues, that's a city problem. And so then that adds another layer of stigma and shame. And so being able to speak out about it. Mr. Reed, I saw a meme going around today, and it was a picture of a receipt at a restaurant, and a woman had written, "Thank you for all you do. I'm alive because of you. Keep doing it. Opioid addict." And she bought the meals of the EMT group that was in the restaurant. Whether that's true or not, it's the internet, right? But there are so many people out there that can benefit from the naloxone, and I know law enforcement was initially resistant to it because law enforcement locks people up. They don't hug them. Yeah. But so how has that changed with the law getting naloxone to folks?
It certainly has been a hallmark of a shift of the paradigm, if I can use that phrase. Law enforcement has been traditionally kind of the first responder and responsible agency collectively for situations like this, and it's been a burden for them to bear, and I think they kind of feel portrayed these days as the bad guy. But I'll tell you, historically, when you see a drug deal go down in your park in your neighborhood, or when you observe suspicious behavior in your neighborhood and you want somebody to know about it, you don't call an intervention specialist or a crisis manager. You call the police. And they have responded. And because we are in a place right now where a lot of this conduct is still criminal conduct and police have a responsibility to public safety to do something about that, we have herded a lot of drug offenders into the criminal justice system, and the system itself, the overall system, has not responded well. There's gaps, there's deficiencies, and I think a lot of it's related to the ability to provide what the individual needs. That is a shift that is occurring in our country now, and I think with first responders having access to a drug that's going to revive someone from an overdose who would otherwise have died and become yet another statistic in an ever-increasing, again, mind-boggling numbers. Now we have at least the ability to save lives. And the next question is, for all families in crisis, for emergency room providers, for first responders, okay, what do I do now? And so I think on the policy side, we have to be prepared to build it, whatever it's going to be, and a continuum of care from revival to intervention, crisis management, detox, treatment, and recovery, all in the same seamless continuum. And you can imagine as a policy matter that the legislature's going to look at us and say, well, what is that going to cost? And our response is going to be, it's going to cost a whole lot less than what we're doing now. And we can quantify that. So this is where the shift begins. This is why I think General Reyes is dedicated to this. He's been passionate about this for the last 2 years and you know, even before, but with the creation of the task force and the commitment out of our office to participate in this transition, I think there's much to look forward to. We have a lot to do, but there's a lot to look forward to.
I want to get to some questions out here, but I do. You have a story you want to share.
I have a great answer.
And General Reyes, I want to know about the lawsuits against Big Pharma, too.
Scott, you made me think of a story, and the question itself did. When naloxone efforts were first rolling out in the state, and there was some kind of resistance from law enforcement to carry naloxone, that's not our job. You know, I heard some pretty awful things sometimes about this is just natural selection, depending on where the community was at the time. And I'll tell you, there has been a tremendous shift in the last 3 years in the way that the enforcement community views these efforts. But one of the very rural, very impacted areas by this epidemic, my brother Sam and I went down to do a training with their law enforcement, and we're always really open about, you know, this isn't about me shoving anything down anyone's throat. I want to educate you. I want to teach you about a tool you have. I want you to teach me about what your life, what your experience is like. Let's see if we can figure out a way to navigate this together. There was an officer down in, I'm not going to throw out the town because some of them are small and probably don't have a whole lot of officers, but when we finished teaching about it and telling them how to use it, and every single one of them had seen naloxone be used by EMS, I said, all right, tell me what your thoughts are. Tell me, you know, what you think about all this. And this guy let me have it. He said, you want to know what my thoughts are? You really want to know? He said, I'm pissed off. I already have 50 jobs. Look at my belt. Look at all this stuff I got. I already got to do a bunch of jobs that I wasn't trained to do that aren't my job, but I got to do in this community. And you're giving me one more job. I'm not medical. I don't know how to do this. And he's in a place where it may take 20 minutes for EMS to get there. He truly will be that decider of whether or not somebody lives potentially. And we went through it and I said, you know, I actually don't disagree with you. I'm kind of pissed off. I got to teach grandmas how to use this. I'm kind of pissed off. I had to teach a 14-year-old how to revive their mom. I'm kind of pissed off that we're in this boat together and this is really right now the best we can do. We got through it all. We all had lunch. About a month later, he called me and I picked up the phone. He said, hey, it's me. I'm pissed off again. I thought, oh, this could be any number of people right now, but I'm pretty sure I know who this is. And I said, what I do now? And he said, turns out he had used naloxone the night before on somebody and it saved somebody's life. And he said, I'm pissed off at you now because it was a lot easier when I didn't care. And it was exactly for me that moment. It still gives me shivers because that is exactly it. It is a lot easier not to care. We all get caregiver fatigue. It's easier to be angry than it is to be crushed. And I think that what naloxone has done for watching these communities of enforcement and criminal justice is there has been a more of an awakening that what we've been doing is needs to be shifted and that they want these tools to change the next steps, that it isn't just take them to an ER or take them to a jail. We got to do better by folks. We got to have handoffs. We got to have other support systems. So anyway, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
That brought to my mind what that was.
So General Reyes, there's counties that are signed in the lawsuit. Are we signed on now as a state?
Yes, we have. We filed a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, which is the largest manufacturer of the opioids that have fueled this epidemic. But before I answer the question specifically about the lawsuits, I want to give you some context because I think a lot of people only think about it in terms of, well, this is the silver bullet. Let's go after the evil manufacturers and that will take care of this issue and problem. It is one solution to a very complex pattern of different contributors to the thing. So I want to try to illustrate quickly by the larger lay of the land and then answer the lawsuit question. Clearly manufacturers, at least I believe, and I have evidence or I wouldn't have filed a lawsuit, knew that their product was addictive, and for corporate greed, they sent it out into the hands of physicians, telling them with studies that they paid for that it wasn't as addictive. And because doctors were trying to do the right thing and help their patients, I think they were unwitting accomplices in that for a generation. And many of us due to just sports injuries or a minor back injury. We went and believed our physicians because that's what we're taught to do. And we believed them when they said, take all of it, because that's what we do with penicillin. And we took all of it. And we didn't need to take all of it. And because of that, we've lost far too many. That definitely lays at the feet of those companies. And we will hold them accountable for that. That's what we're doing. And we're representing the entire state. We're working with other AGs throughout the nation. It's going to be a big lawsuit, but there are legal impediments and hurdles. And we won't get trillions of dollars. Those companies don't have trillions of dollars. Unlike the large tobacco companies that funded us for billions of dollars decades ago, these companies aren't that big. They're big. They call them big pharma. They're not nearly as big as tobacco. So I wanted to throw out a little bit of a context for that. There are also manufacturers, they're distributors who took those manufactured drugs and made sure that they got them into commercial entities. We're investigating them. We're going to file lawsuits potentially against some of them. You have physicians and the whole medical community that is realizing their own role and responsibility, and I think many of them have stepped up, and as a body, I think they've become much more attuned and responsible. That's great. You have the pharmacies that fill the prescriptions. And just a few years ago, when people were telling me, don't talk about this issue, it's not good for you politically. Nobody will want to hear about it, and you'll never get reelected. And we said, we don't really care. That's not why we're not here just to get reelected. We're here to change and help and protect people. That's at least my view. We went to the pharmacies and asked them to stop, to actually self-regulate. Even if a doctor prescribed 30 days, say, we're only going to fill three. And the pharmacy's response, which I understand from a corporate standpoint and their obligation to their shareholders, was, why should we do that? Like, what's in it for us? What? There's no law. There's nothing requiring us to do that. Why should we do that? And we started to tell them the story. The good news, last year, these same pharmacies, not just because of the attorneys general, many other voices, your voices, your parents' voices, telling them to do something, many of the biggest pharmacies like Walgreens and CVS, they started to implement their own limits. So they will only fill 3 days, and then you'll have to go back and get another prescription. They're looking at electronic scripts to reduce fraud. All of these things that are happening, that's the good news, is that we can change over time. You have law enforcement, which plays a critical role. And Scott mentioned issues like fentanyl. Do you know how dangerous fentanyl is right now and how profitable that is? On a $10,000 buy, you can make $100 million. I'm not exaggerating that one because we have cases and we know. So if you have that kind of profitability, anybody will try that. And they don't care how many people they kill by sending these. Regular fentanyl is dangerous enough, but when you're ginning it up in some, you know, basement with no quality control at all, and you're getting it, sourcing it from China without any quality control, you do not know what you're sending out. And people are taking one pill and dying. It is so potent. It's a million times carfentanil more potent than morphine, because morphine, I think, is 1,000 times more potent. Fentanyl is 1,000 times more potent than morphine. Carfentanil in its purest form, 1,000 times that. So orders of magnitude. When we go in with the DEA, we have to be in like double hazmat, not we, because I don't go, but our agents, double hazmat suits, just because any exposure to their skin could be instantly fatal. That's what we're dealing with. It is so lucrative, that trade, that law enforcement continues to have a significant role. But education, people like Jenny McKenzie, who have created films that are shown at Sundance, like Dying in Vain, that's a critical part of the fight. Utah Naloxone, technology companies that are helping us change how we take in opioids. Some people need them. We're not saying that every use, unless Jen disagrees with me, but every use of opioids is evil, inherently bad. Managed correctly in the proper dosage, under the care, in the right circumstances, there is a role for them. But I wanted to paint this picture for you because each and every one of those, there are hurdles that we have to overcome. There are people that we have to get to buy in. And last but not least, the insurance companies, because what's not represented on this panel is an expert, a leader from the treatment and recovery program. And that's perhaps the most important component of everything that we're doing. Jen keeps them alive. We go get the bad guys. But what do we do with them long term, these our brothers and our sisters and our children? And insurance companies right now, maybe we're where we were back with the pharmacy companies. We're asking them to be more generous in what they're covering and to cover alternatives to traditional opioids for pain. So the lawsuit will continue to push forward. Don't worry about that. We will hold people accountable. But even if we won tens of millions of dollars, the state of Utah, what are we going to do with that? That's got to be deployed the right way into these different, this ecosystem that I'm talking about, which is so complex. I hope that kind of does justice to the complexity of what we're talking about.
Thank you so much.
And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Questions. Right here, we'll go straight in the back.
How do you guys think that if Proposition 2 is to get passed, or if it doesn't get passed, how do you think that that would affect the opioid crisis?
Mr. Reed, that sounds like your area.
That's an easy one. Depending on what happens with Prop 2, the Attorney General's office is the agency that not only enforces the law, but also represents the agencies that implement the law. We are in a position where we really can't weigh in at this point, because that would be essentially a comment on a law before it was passed made by the office that is charged with enforcing it. So we really can't weigh in specifically on that. You will see there's, and you guys do your research online, and that's great. You should continue to do research. There are studies on both sides of the issue of whether or not marijuana as a medicine is going to assist in overcoming the opioid crisis or merely going to exacerbate it in other forms. And that's a very vigorous debate right now, and I don't know that there's any solution.
Mr. Parker.
I'm going to pass
down. Dr. Plum.
Now I knew this mic would end up with me. You know, the challenge with the cannabis discussions is that it's so heated, right? And there is so much kind of vigor surrounding it. And for me, the big piece, the most frustrating thing to me, is that it's a Schedule I substance. One of my biggest disappointments from the previous administration, from the Obama administration, is that this was not made a Schedule II substance, because that would have allowed us to do research, to look into some of these. I think there is a great hope from many that there will be utility that will allow a lot of things to progress differently. I work in pediatrics, where some of the best data on medical cannabis use comes from kids with intractable seizures, and to watch the difference that it makes in these kids' lives, it's undeniable. And unfortunately, because of the way it's been scheduled, we haven't been able to research it to get similar data on other conditions. And, you know, some folks, when I talk about wanting more data, will say, oh, you're just trying to delay. You're just trying to delay being legalized. No, really, I'm not. I'm a potential prescriber who wants to know how to prescribe things appropriately for folks. For me personally, just literally speaking as me, myself, and watching people in this, there are, I think, undoubtedly going to be uses for cannabis. Will it change the opioid epidemic? No. The people who are already dependent and addicted to these substances, you can't fix that with cannabis. Is having another option potentially going to be a way that we have less people getting directed to opioids? I think there's great hope for that, and I personally have great hope for that. But there's going to be so much kind of in the muck as this comes out. I wish there could be less fury and more just honest dialogue about what we all want from this. I don't want people locked up related to cannabis offenses. I just don't think that makes any sense to me. It should be decriminalized. It largely has incarcerated people, especially of disproportionately people of color and less resources. So I don't want it to be a punishable, criminalizable offense. That being said, I'd also like it to be used in the best way possible. If we're going to call it a medical substance, we got to have medical data. Yeah. So that's where I come out.
Can
on
I address just briefly that too? Again, just as Scott said, we can't advocate one way or the other in terms of the ballot initiative, because we may be defending that same law if it passes. But I do want to say this. If you step back, I have not met a single person in this debate or issue even those who oppose that particular ballot initiative, who aren't hopeful for some kind of application for cannabis in a medicinal way. Everybody thinks that that is a good idea. The disconnect is this particular ballot initiative the best vehicle to get us where we need to be? And of course, there's a lot of daylight in between that. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot of accusations for people all around, like Jen said, Dr. Plum said. And if we would dial that back a little bit and all say, look, we do want to, I think we're all a lot closer than we think. Maybe we have a disagreement on, again, the vehicle. I wanted to clarify that because I think we all do hope that cannabis could be a potential alternative to opioids and people who are already, if you can imagine, drawing the lottery. You just take one opioid. If you're predisposed to that, I mean, you're already addicted and hooked on your, and I'm, is that right, Jenna?
For
I mean,
some
for some people, that's my understanding. And so, again, I wanted to emphasize that, if we can Got dial it. Down the rhetoric a little bit on that.
No worries. Let's get a couple more questions before we're done here.
Hi.
Is that on?
Yes.
Hi. I had a question about unintentional sort of addiction here in Utah. I saw some data that in Utah, pregnant women are prescribed opioids at a much higher rate than most other states in the United States. I wanted to see if that is true, and that it's also pregnant women who were not necessarily on opioids before they were pregnant, but being prescribed opioids for back pain when they're pregnant, and then getting addicted, and the babies being addicted. And I also saw some data that suggests that dentists are some of the healthcare providers that are prescribing the most opioids. Absolutely. What are we doing about that? That seems insane.
Dr. Plum?
So I would love to see what some of the data is. I saw some other heads nodding about that because obviously, that is one of it, pregnant people. You prescribe to a pregnant person, you are prescribing to two people, if not more, in that moment. So I would that terrifies me. That being said, there certainly are, say you have a kidney stone while you're pregnant and someone wants you to take a couple of doses for a couple of days to get through that, or you get pancreatitis, a really awful situation sometimes when you're pregnant. I would never advocate for people to suffer. And so for me personally, I don't write opiate prescriptions. I think if someone needs an opiate, they need to be hospitalized. That's also the population I work in pediatrics. So I would love to explore that more. I think that to me, makes my hair crawl. So yeah, if it is true, we need to address it better. Dentists are absolutely, and oral surgeons are absolutely some of our biggest prescribers of opiates. It is a difficult dialogue with any prescriber to say, we want you to change the way you practice or the way you take care of your patients. You can't really legislate that. You can't really legislate the practice of medicine. You can certainly incentivize things. And I think it's got to come from within the communities. I mean, that's where I see it changing within physicians, is when physicians, for lack of a better term, kind of shame each other of you did what? You write how many what? I mean, we look at a group of prescribers and say, all right, I want to see where I compare to my other colleagues. I don't want to be this outlier. I don't want to be that person. I want to be kind of in the middle. And so we've got to be education ways, but I am very disappointed in my profession. I'm very disappointed in my colleagues. Over the past years, there has been so much education about how much we need to change our prescribing practices. And
I have a question, though. In your training, and coming up through med school and your residency and your specialization, how much training did you get in pain management, which has changed significantly, I'm guessing, since you were in med school?
Maybe an hour. Maybe. Mm-hmm. And then it became what you saw people practicing, you know, on the wards or in their clinics. So you learn very much anecdotally from how people were. And I went to start in med school in 96 to 2000. In that time, there was
huge change.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But we've got, we put prescribing guidelines in place, but they're only guidelines. Mayo Clinic just published something in British Medical Journal in August of this year that there's essentially in the last 10 years not been a significant change in our prescribing patterns. There are moonshots. You know, Intermountain says we're going to decrease acute prescribing by 40%, and it's a good idea, but it's not translating.
Well, and doctors are not going to take a bean counter telling them how to practice medicine.
No.
That's that clash right there. Mr. Reed, though, Rocky Mountain High Intensity Drug Traffic. What's that acronym? Well,
HIDA.
Here's my
Sounds
question.
Sounds like a drug term, I guess.
Yeah, here's my question, because when maybe 5-10 years ago when this started coming up and HIDA was addressing doctors felt under siege for their prescription practices. And then pain management doesn't get addressed. It's this weird catch-22. So yeah, what did you see from that?
There are great complexities, and let me just back up to what Jen was talking about, talk about the dentist situation a little bit, because I think the tide continues to shift, and it begins to raise all the ships towards a common goal here. But what we have is historically a patient who comes in and says, hey, doc, it hurts when I do this, and the doc says, don't do that. And then opioids come along, and the shift was, hey, it hurts when I do this. Well, try 30 days of this. And let me know how you do. Well, we know how they did. And so now there's a much more collaborative process. And I think you all, as young adults and patients, need to question your doctor with regard to your health. It's your health. She's the doc, but you're the patient, and you need to know what it is that you're getting into. And you need to ask those questions. And I think more than ever, that's a very responsible dialogue that's occurring. What is also occurring is a recognition of professional responsibility related to this, and I want to say, highly regulated industry. The opioid industry, controlled substances as a group, are highly regulated by the federal government, and as a result, whether we like it or not, there is information contained in a database that tells about our prescription history when it comes to controlled substances. We're all in there. If you've had a toothache and you've gone to the doc and gotten hydrocodone or any of those other drugs, you're in there too. But what we want to encourage is the patient who comes in and says, hey, doc, it hurts when I do this, without any other objective manifestation of pain, and pain is so subjective anyway, for the doc not to say, well, let's take a look at your history here. I see you're receiving this from Dr. So-and-so. How's that going? And do you think this is going to help any more than that? And just open up the dialogue. So, HIDA is actually a law enforcement function. We started creating them, I think, 20 years ago, and DEA has been a repository of a lot of them. Make the distinction, however, HIDA is fund high-intensity drug trafficking areas across the country, Miami, Los Angeles, traditional places where importation was occurring. They've spread all over the country. But now HIDA has always been funded out of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, sometimes called the Drug Czar's Office, which is within the White House. It's a presidential office. So it's a separate funding source. And HIDA kind of emphasizes the notion that if we have drug importation occurring in our country, we need to try to get to the source, whether it's the source in Mexico or the source in China, and that those efforts are focused on the macro side of things. They're not street-level enforcement. They don't do buy bus and go out and have undercover guys, sitting in the park waiting for a transaction to occur. So it's focused on supply, but on a macro level. And I don't know if you want to.
I think we're just about out of time, so do you have anything else you'd like to add as a closing statement?
I do. Sitting here today, the good news is this. We know more about treatment and addiction than we knew 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. There is still much to learn. One of the things we're learning about addiction, and it's not just drug addiction, is gambling, pornography, alcohol, you name the addiction, there are some commonalities, one of which is early childhood trauma. Another of which is this notion that the recovery folks will tell you the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. Mm-hmm. People who are addicted tend to be isolated, dissociated, and we need to find a way. It's our responsibility to our fellow brothers and sisters to find a way to help them reconnect and reduce the susceptibility to addiction.
Mr. Parker.
Thank you. In my opening comments, I mentioned something that we announced just a couple of days ago, and I'll wrap up with that. As we've reached out to rural communities, we've identified some critical needs. And Tuesday this week, we announced nearly $400,000 of USDA Rural Development grants. Three of those focus on Carbon County. Now, the thing that's important here is we're partnering with communities and nonprofits to address these issues. And I just wanted to note, we work with community groups, and we announced two ambulances that are equipped with opiate emergency equipment because I mentioned how isolated they are, this gives them a chance to get to care. And so in Sevier County and in East Carbon City, we provided funding for ambulances. We also are working with Four Corners Behavioral Health on three vehicles to transport people in that area for detox, rehab, and that type of thing, as well as a sober living facility. So we're working with those communities on some of the needs that they've identified as we've reached out to them.
Mr. Parker, before you pass that microphone, is there a website or way to get in touch with you if anyone here says, you know, my hometown could use some of this support?
We do have a web page at the USDA website, and it's specifically for opiates. It's had 33,000 hits, and I will provide that. I'm not exactly sure, but it is at the USDA Rural Development website,
okay,
and it's a page on opiate assistance.
Great. General Reyes.
First of all, thank you all for coming. You really are a key to helping us solve this issue. Your social media impact alone here cumulatively is incredible. I want to thank you all, by the way, for letting me sit in the Randy Dreyer endowed panelist chair. He was one of my mentors, and I know I wanted to get that on film so that he didn't feel like I was being unappreciative.
You can use that in your next campaign commercial.
Yeah, Randy Dreyer. The other thing is, look, I'm proud of the U. My son attends here. He studies quant analytics. Analytics and data are such a key piece to this. A lot of the legislation that we've passed is to get better information. But this is the challenge to you and young, brilliant minds, is to try to figure out how we manipulate that information, manipulate in a positive way to be able to detect, get ahead of, not just now but into the future, crises like this. And so, you know, we are investigating a number of technologies. Right now we're looking at one that we may soon have an MOU for that will help us look at all of the vast data that we have to help pinpoint certain areas that we can deploy scarce assets to in this opioid fight. So we're proud of that. We're proud of what you represent here at the University of Utah. Thanks for being here today.
Dr. Plum.
Well, likewise, I ended up in the Norma Matheson chair, so I think that we got lucky with where we got planted. So, it's pretty awesome. I think that, kind of to echo a bit of what Attorney General Reyes was saying, there is so much needed in the way of culture shift and new thinking and new blood and young minds that are not going to tolerate the status quo as it has been, and they're going to ask questions and they're going to challenge the way things have been. I'm very hopeful having you all here is that something in your mind made you think, I don't like that, or I'd like to change that, or I'd like to be a part of that, because we can pass laws and I can make people tear up as often as I don't mean to, but I often do. But without literally an army of people who say, we won't tolerate this longer, we won't take these deaths happening any longer, these people matter way too much to us, it won't shift. So always feel free to reach out to us at Utah Naloxone if there's someone you're worried about or someone you want to be involved in the community. The Praxis Honors Lab did a great program here, and now the Benyon Center has an opportunity for people who want to build naloxone kits and help get them out into their community. The U is being engaged. U students are being engaged, and I'm grateful to be able to be here and be a part of it.
Website, Facebook?
Yeah, both. Utah Naloxone has just utahnaloxone.org, and Facebook is Utah Naloxone, or I've ended up as Jen Naloxone Plum on there as well. So you can find us that way, phone numbers. But anyway.
13th also.
Summit. Yes. Let's pass the microphone down to Mr. Reed. He's got seconds.
I just want to give you a search term, because I believe the website is Utah Solutions, plural, summit.com. You can find information to register there. If that's not it, if I got one of the letters wrong, I apologize. Just search that term. It's October 12th, Vivint Center Arena. You're all welcome. It's an all-day event. The morning's going to be directed at younger adults, high school age. But certainly the discussion in the afternoon will be very pertinent with a tremendous amount of leadership in the building throughout the day.
Mr. Parker's got a website.
I do have a website now. Thank you. It's www.usda.gov/topics, T-O-P-I-C-S, /opioids, O-P-I-O-D, opioids.
Opioids. Thank you so much to our panel for being here and keeping this conversation going. You for being here.
Thank you to those speaking on today's panel, Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes, Utah Naloxone Director Dr. Jennifer Plum, USDA State Director Randy Parker, Utah Assistant Attorney General Scott Reed, and producer at local radio station KRCO, Laura Jones, for helping moderate today's panel. If you'd like to hear the full discussion, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund, and I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.